It is with excitement that I get to share with you that the Leukemia Foundation has developed a new resource. This resource is called the Online Support Service, where it provides a wealth of services to assist a person living with blood cancer throughout their patient journey. So whether you're a patient who has just been diagnosed, in treatment or in survivorship, this service provides access to targeted learning modules, a suite of amazing services and online programs. And you also have the ability to chat with an experienced blood cancer support coordinator at just one click. It gives people a personalized and intuitive way to learn about important topics, including what to expect beyond treatment. This service is simple to use and is filled with content curated by the Leukemia Foundation for people with any type of blood cancer. It notably features a digital energy coach to help patients manage fatigue. So jump onto our website and look up our new and exciting product called the Online Blood Cancer Support Service.
You get to a point in life where you think you're in control of everything, and all of a sudden it gets taken out from underneath you.
I guess I kind of felt ripped off.
It's just living in the moment and just being adaptable to situations.
Give people voices to talk about, you know what, that phase is often the hardest, and be prepared for it because it's not what you think it will be.
Talking Blood Cancer, a podcast for those facing blood cancer by the Leukemia Foundation.
Find the best way forward using their own purpose that they have in their life and using their passions.
I've lost fear and doubt. Like, I no longer doubt myself in situations, and nothing scares me.
That gives you another goal to work towards and a reason to live.
I'm Kate Arkadiv, and I am the host of Talking Blood Cancer. This podcast shares the stories of the people we have connected with who have faced a blood cancer, so that you, our listeners, can gain insight, find purpose, and take inspiration. Before we get into today's episode, the Leukemia Foundation acknowledges the traditional owners of the land on which we share these stories. We recognise their continuing connection to land, sea and community as the first storytellers of this country. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present. This story may contain content that some listeners may find difficult and challenging. We encourage anyone listening to take care of their own mental health and well-being. The purpose of this podcast is to share real-life stories of people living with a blood cancer, and any discussion of medical treatments is not an endorsement. We encourage you to seek advice from your treatment team if you have any questions regarding your diagnosis, side effects, or treatment. If you would like to talk to someone, or even if you would like more information on our services or today's episode, please feel free to contact 1-800-620-420, and someone will be able to connect you with your local blood cancer support coordinator. So, let's get into today's episode. In today's episode, I speak with Vicky Palau, who, at age 29, was diagnosed with stage 4 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in August 2016. Vicky and her husband, who were only married 6 months before her diagnosis, were both fly-in and fly-out workers based out of Western Australia. And they both worked big hours, so this diagnosis came at such a shock. What was more of a shock for Vicky was the mental recovery post-treatment. Vicky talks about how you have to work out how to live mentally well with the fear of relapse, body changes, potential infertility, the loss of employment or finances. Vicky also speaks to her journey into motherhood, post-treatment, and how she was blessed with not one, but two miracle babies without IVF support. I hope you all enjoyed today's episode. It is truly a raw and honest episode with a spark of magic.
Well, hi, Vicky. Thank you so much for coming on today. And what we usually start off with is just asking you to maybe explain to the listeners who you are, where you live in the world, who is in your family, and what were you diagnosed with and when?
Sure. Hi. My name is Vicky Pellow. I currently live in Perth, but I'm originally from the UK. My family includes my husband, Mike, my little girl, Maya, and currently very pregnant with the any day now. So that will be the rest of my family.
Yeah.
And I was diagnosed in 2016 with stage 4 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for sharing your time today, especially as you said, being so very heavily pregnant and due to give birth any day now. So I appreciate your time. So what you know, when you were diagnosed, what was happening for you around that time? What was taking place in your life and where were you at?
Yeah, so it was a very out of the blue diagnosis, for want of a better word. We got married in March 2016 and everything was normal. I had no symptoms. I had no inkling whatsoever that anything was wrong. And by about July, I'd noticed just a lump in my neck. And I was FIFO at the time, fly in, fly out, for those people in WA. And I was due to fly out a few days later. And I thought, oh God, I'm going to be away for a month. I need to just get some antibiotics just to get whatever this is done. Assuming it was just some kind of, you know, glands up or something like that, because I was 29, I was young, fit and healthy. I'd never
expected anything less.
So I went to the doctor and started, you know, waiting to find out, and they were, oh, we'll just do this, we'll just do that. I was like, okay. Flew back to work because assuming everything was fine. Then got a call from a doctor saying you need to come back for further tests, which was a bit confusing. And then said to my boss, I said, oh, I'll just fly down and do the test and then I'll come back again. I'll take my computer, I'll be gone, you know, 24 hours and 48 hours and I'll come back. And, yeah, after a month of testing and all sorts of diagnostics and different bits and pieces, I was diagnosed with stage 4 non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which in itself was a real shock because I had literally just found a lump in my neck and that was it. There was no unexplained weight loss, there were no night sweats, there were no other sort of pretty glaringly obvious symptoms which non-Hodgkin's lymphoma quite often has.
And at stage 4 too as well.
Yeah. So I remember thinking, well, what happened to stage 1, 2 and 3? Why didn't I have any signs? Like
how did we get to this point?
Right. And yeah, it was a real shock. There's no history of it in my family. There is no as I said, there was no real warning signs. And I got to the stage where when I was diagnosed, my diagnosing hematologist, I'd sort of said to her, well, why? How? Why me? And she said, you know what? There's no reason. It's just bad luck. And in some ways, a few friends of mine have said, would a reason have been better? And I was like, I don't know, because I don't have a reason. So it was a very unusual time at 29 to then be told you have stage 4 cancer and this could be it for you. Yeah. So.
And who was with you at the time when you were diagnosed? Like, I mean, you'd said to your boss, look, I'm just going to go away for 24 hours. And it was a long 24 hours turned into a month. Like, was anybody with you when you heard that news?
Yes, I was very lucky. My husband was also FIFO, so we were both sort of, and again, every sort of diagnostic that we took and every scan and every biopsy, we were both thinking, oh, it can't be cancer. It can't. Obviously, we've been told it could be at some stage, but it can't be cancer. I'm 29. There's nothing wrong with me. I'm 29. I'm young, fit and healthy. It can't be cancer. And so I went through all that with my husband at some of the appointments. Some of them I went to by myself. I'm fortunate enough that my dad also lives here. So he's from the UK as well. But my dad and my extended family are from, my stepmom's extended family are from Perth. So I had people come with me to appointments, which was great. Mm-hmm. And then when it was the official diagnosis, I had my dad and my husband in the room because I said, I need you to help me ask questions. I need you to help me, you know, write things down that I can't remember. And my biggest question was around fertility, because I'd done some research. I'd been mindful not to go too far down the Dr. Google rabbit hole, because we all know that's never good.
Never, ever.
But, you know, when you're sitting there waiting and wondering, it's natural. It's natural.
What else do you do?
Exactly. And it's really hard to say to somebody, don't Google. Whereas at the same time, you sort of want to be a bit prepared with some questions and some options. And yeah, so I had them with me, which was great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you're right, because people do, you almost want to prepare yourself and soften that shock if you can of what if, and as you said, prepare yourself. And what was the doctor's response? Like you got delivered the news, and then did you go straight into fertility options and talk, or were you more what's treatment and what does that look like being stage four?
Kind of a bit of both, because I remember saying to her, I said, look, I have heard that chemo can leave you infertile. What does that mean for me? Because that is a big priority for me. I'd never imagine not having kids. And I remember her saying to me, if you go away for 6 months and you come back, I can't treat you, that you will be terminal.
Wow. Wow.
However, if you have the treatment is very positive. You know, there are really good results for my type of cancer and my type of treatment, which was R-CHOP chemotherapy. However, yes, it will impact your fertility. There is a chance you could be left infertile. So that was what broke me, not hearing I had cancer. For some reason, I had this sort of gut feeling. I was like, right, I can get through the cancer, but I can't get through infertility. I can't risk not being able to have children. And
because for some of us women, we've dreamt about being a mother from the time we were literally toddlers playing with babies. And for some of us, it's such an innate feeling and desire to have. So I can totally understand why that would break you over that.
Totally. Like it was A, the shock of having cancer, and B, the shock of if I do survive, my life is completely different at 29 than I ever thought it could be. So it was sort of it was almost like a double whammy, really. I had to decide, you know, do I take the risk of not having the treatment, but then I wouldn't survive anyway and I wouldn't be able to have children. It's not a great place to be put in, but then you always have options. You do have the options, and I chose many.
And what were those options?
For me?
Yeah.
Take the treatment or probably don't survive. They weren't great options. Having said that, you know, I could have explored other avenues. Absolutely, there are always different avenues to explore. I just chose to take the treatment and take my chances and focus on preserving my fertility in any way possible, shape or form that I could. Again, when you're diagnosed, you feel very out of control, like massive. And I'd always been a very organized control freak. I was very good at my job, which involved organizing FIFO, you know, all this kind of stuff.
Yes.
Very much like to be in control. And cancer takes all control away from you completely and utterly. And you feel like your body is out of control, your choices are out of control, everything. So I made the choice to sort of let go of that control side of things and just focus on what could I choose and what could I do to support myself.
And how did you do that?
I had support. So I had Reiki therapy, and I had friends and family I could talk to. I've got quite a strong mental health background and interest in psychology, so I worked a lot with my own processes through that, informal counselling, all those sorts of things, just a lot of talking therapies, because a lot of sort of getting out. And obviously a lot of my friends, God love them, I had no idea what to say, because I had no idea what to say. We were in our 20s. We weren't meant to be getting cancer. We were meant to be, you know, having babies and living our lives, quite.
Yes.
So it was a very strange time. And the best thing, I still remember one of my best mates saying to me, I went round, we just sat at the dinner table, and she said to me, I just don't know what to say. And I said, neither do I, but that's great. Just keep talking to me. Like, don't, just because we don't know what to say, don't just say nothing and sort of fade away into the background, which some people do and some people did. And that is more confronting for the cancer patient, because they feel even more isolated, where actually if people just step up and say, this is really, really, I'm going to swear, really shit. And I don't know what to say. How can I help? What can I say? And then you kind of laugh about it together. We'll get through it together by saying, I don't know, just say what you say. And if it's wrong, I'll tell you.
But I think that's so important, because in society, we're not very good at dealing with the hard things or dealing with other people's emotions that may be confronting, or situations, say, like death or grief and loss, which cancer is very much all of that, grief and loss. And to be able to have, I've sat in front of so many people, have said, like, people just either back away or they don't say anything to me, and that makes me feel worse, or I just want to say this, but I don't want to upset them and then have to manage their feelings. You're right. Like, if you just name it and say it, go, I don't know what to say, that's actually a beautiful opener to help start a conversation.
Completely, because chances are the person with cancer doesn't know what to say either. They're making it, you know, muddling it through themselves. And it's that sort of crucial point where you find that talking about grief and loss and cancer and death and infertility is all very, very, very intense topics that a lot of people haven't had to deal with, or haven't, or just deal with one at a time, not all at once.
Absolutely. Yes.
So
it is
that fear of, I want to help you, but I don't know what to do. And it's easier if I do nothing, because then there's no risk of me upsetting anyone.
Yeah.
But the cancer world is really lonely. Especially in the AYA world, which is adolescent and young adult world. It's really isolating, because you are a small minority, and it's the time when you need your friends and family to really, really support you more than ever.
Absolutely. That's so powerful, and I think that so many others can resonate with that. And even I think no matter what age you are, it is a really isolating time. You spend time in isolation away from the general public and away from your usual life and your usual support. So you almost have to begin creating, as you said, you had to bring in that village of support for you to help get you through that period. And it always blows my mind. It's a little bit backwards that when the person who is struggling the most, they have to draw everyone in, where it actually almost should be the other way. The village comes to the person, not the person goes to the village to gather them in.
Yeah, and it's hard because people mean well. Like, people, I've got sort of like a, it sounds awful, but I've got sort of like an email or a list of things that when people say to me, oh my God, my friend's got cancer, how can I help them? I'll send it to them and say, right, this is a really good place to start. I'm not the person going through it right now. Yeah. So you know your friend better than anyone. Take or leave this with a giant bucket of salt. But essentially, people mean well and they want to help, but they say things like, oh, let me know what I can do to help. And the person that puts it back on the person with cancer, and the person with cancer going, oh God, I'm knackered. Will you just help?
Do I have to think of something for you, a job for you on top of everything else?
Yeah. I have to contact you to ask. Yeah, it is very much they mean well and they do want to help. And that's the thing. Like, they're not saying it to be dismissive. It's more a case of, I don't know what you need, please let me know. But for somebody particularly like myself, and again, I'm speaking from personal experience, I don't want to generalize too much, but somebody who has been, you know, young, strong, independent female, you know, earned her own money, worked, you know, lived her own life, to all of a sudden have to ask for a lot of help, was again a very confronting change in circumstance. And being able to accept that help is one of the absolute greatest things to come out of my cancer experience, to be perfectly honest with you. But also even knowing what to ask, it sounds daft, but you kind of, especially at the beginning when everybody wants to help, cancer, God love it, takes a while, and by the end people have changed, people have moved on, life changes. But especially in the beginning, when you haven't really started treatment yet and you don't really know what you need, you don't know what to ask for. So you say, oh, no, I'm fine. And then 3 months down the track, when you're pretty heavily into treatment, you've got a bit more of an idea. So
the dust has settled.
Yeah, definitely. And then the dust has settled and some people are still there, which is great, and some people have moved on. Like, as I say, the cancer experience itself can be very isolating, because you are put on pause, is how I describe it to a lot of people. Like, so chemo brain does the same thing, because it literally stops you remembering anything. but your life is on pause. Like you can't really move forward because you don't know what's happening. You're not going backwards. You're just sort of, you're surviving. You're in survival mode. So whereas the rest of the world is sort of moving on.
Yeah, and you're right. We have you watch it. People describe it as watching another movie go on, and you're stuck in your own spot. And because you don't have any control of what's going to even happen the next day, or the next hour, or your next treatment, and it just it just controls so much of your life.
Absolutely, you are you're living to survive, and you don't know how many days you've got to live. And whilst you hope that the treatment is successful, that it is only X amount of chemos that they've told you, but then you go in,
what
and
if?
Then it changes, and that's out of your hands. You have another scan, and it hasn't reacted the way that the doctors predicted it would. So that changes. Like you live very much day to day, and enjoy trying to plan for the future, but also know that any plans. I described it to my friend the other day as a personal pandemic, because it is literally like you can try and plan for even a week ahead, but you don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah. And how did you go with that change? I mean, I know you said you had a village of support through that, but that lack of control of not being able to know what you could do, because I speak to many young people or even others, they go, I can't plan for the future and that. And being able to plan and have a goal and have purpose is so important to humans. And how did you go about managing not being able to do that or adapting to that way of life?
So that was one of the hardest changes for me, especially with the constant thoughts in my head around fertility. You know, what am I going to be left with if I am fortunate enough to survive? And that was the sort of the challenging part, to try and find alternative ways that I could support myself and choices that I made. So I talk a lot about choices, because I did find myself looking into alternatives. So I found alternative ways to support my health and my mental health through those times. Ironically, people, this is probably self-sabotaging, but I'd watch food programs on SBS. I can name you a lot of Vietnamese food programs, because I couldn't eat anything because I was so sick. But for some reason, it was just soothing to me to watch these food programs. I don't know
why. Yeah.
I've never watched one since.
That's what you did.
You find little things to support yourself, and little things to support yourself in the day and in the moment. Like I did a lot of work with a Reiki therapist, and she also is a sort of counselor as well, that I worked through a lot of my choices with. And we talked a lot about just the way that your words and your energy can really change perspective. So for me, when I was going into chemo, there's a lot of narrative around it being toxic and it being poison, and it's pretty hard hitting. Like I'm not going to glitter a turd here.
Sure,
it's not fun. But I chose to see it as medicine. So I chose the language that I used to say, right, it's medicine. It's healing my body. It's going around and it's, you know, doing what, and had lots of different visualizations of how I chose to see that in my body. And that's all personal and individual. Everybody's entitled to do what they see fit to make it the easiest for them. But for me, that was the way that I could see it in a more positive light, because the narrative is still very negative around treatment.
Yeah.
And it's particularly negative around, you know, as I say, chemo is talked about toxic and poison and, you know, killing your body, killing the cells. It's all very aggressive and negative. And I'd never even thought of that until she was speaking to me about it. And I thought, you know what, you're right. If I go in there with this sort of fighter mentality, that's exhausting before you've even walked in the door. You're already, you know, hyped up for a fight. You know, it's going to be aggressive. It's going to be, you know.
The energy that takes, gosh.
Exactly. But actually going in saying, right, I'm just here for my medicine to make me better. This is here to save me, this is here to make me survive, essentially, was a very different attitude that I'd never even crossed my mind before, but it was something that I've now, ever since then been very mindful of, and very mindful of the words I use and the words I choose. And that's why I say, like, simple things that you don't have to completely, you know, rewrite your history and everything when you go into a cancer ward. But if you just change some words, or just change a little bit of perspective, anything that helps you feel better, like, I don't, whatever that is, even if, like, you know, you're the biggest gaming nerd when you were a kid, but now you're an adult, you know, you're so busy being adults and doing adulting things, because adulting things are really busy. Now you've got all this time on your hand and you're like, shit, what am I going to do with it? Go back to the things that you did as a kid and that you loved, and just have fun. Like, just do the things that it doesn't, it's also the beauty of cancer. No one really can tell you what they think.
So, you've got the card.
Even if they think that it's absolutely ridiculous for a grown adult to be, you know, doing whatever you want to do, they won't say anything, and you don't.
There's no judgment. Yeah.
And actually, I wish life could be a bit more like that, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah.
It is very much an enlightening moment when you don't know how long you've got left, and then you sort of think, well, what do I want to do? Who do I want to spend my time around? Because actually, I don't have time to deal with all the little shit. I don't have time to deal with people who aren't bringing, you know, positivity or joy to my life. I don't need to worry about that anymore. A lot more shoulder shrugging, a lot more, I can't control it and I can't do anything about it. So I don't need to waste what could be, you know, last few days or weeks of my life on that stuff. So it's, yeah.
The insight, I think, that cancer for some people gives, it almost is that moment where it takes off those rose-coloured glasses and we see life. You know, for a lot of people, we can go through life thinking, as we say, we think the storybook of life will be we'll die when we're 90 in our sleep and it will be fine and peaceful, but we'll still get to hit all those milestones. And then when something comes into life that is completely unexpected and earth-shattering and life-changing, we get that perspective of, oh, God, life is fragile and it can be taken away at times, at any moment. And I think also COVID has helped a lot of people change their perspective and how they would like to live life. And it's a big wake-up call that I know a lot of people do receive. And some people do really struggle with hearing, oh, cancer is the best thing that's happened to me, or this was so, you know, I'm glad this happened. Because, yeah, for some people it's not. They miss the life that they had. But if, as you said, turn perspective and turn it around and go, oh, this, yeah, I can see things in a different light, a more positive light as well.
And I'm very much I do tell people that cancer was the best thing to happen to me. It was also the worst thing to happen to me. Like, I very much am a completely different person now, but I still, survivorship is really tough and I still miss so much about the person that I was. All the unknowns, all the unknowns of what if, you know, what if I could go through life without having to worry that it was going to come back every day, you know, all that sort of, the next stage of cancer after treatment, so the survivorship stage, is incredibly complex in itself, which is something I'm very passionate about talking about, which is how we met.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it is that sort of, especially for AYA, and again, I'm not going to generalize because I was 29 when I was diagnosed, so that is my experience. But we're hit with this sort of life-changing perspective or epiphany or whatever you want to call it, at a time in our lives where there is so much impacted by cancer. It's, you know, fertility, it's relationships, it's finances, it's jobs, it's houses, it's literally everything on our plate that we're just getting started on or in the middle of, or, you know, at the very early stages.
Yes.
It's all those other impacts that cancer has, which when you're sort of older, and I talk about my grandmother had bowel cancer in her 60s, so when she and I talk about it, and we do, when I was going through treatment, we talked about it very regularly. It was a very different experience because she'd had her children, she'd had her career, she'd paid off her mortgage. She was in a very different stage of her life. I'm not saying it was any easier for her. She still had to go through health treatment and all this kind of stuff.
So yes,
there were some similarities, of course. But from a lifestyle perspective and from a survivorship perspective afterwards, very, very different impacts. And I don't claim to know what they were for her specifically, but from an AYA perspective, it has that ripple effect that it impacts so much of your life for so many years after that changes the course of what you thought you were going to be doing, rightly or wrongly. And, you know, it could be better, it could be worse. You don't know. But
absolutely, it's
a massive change.
Because how long were you in treatment for? Did you have to have a transplant or anything like that, or were you just...
No, so I was diagnostics for about a month, and then I did have fertility preservation treatment and then chemo, and then I was in remission in January. So essentially August to January through the whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
What's that? Oh, my maths is shocking. That's 3 or 4 months.
I think it's about 4 to 5 months. Yeah.
So from sort of original diagnostics through all of the treatment and to when I was in remission or declared officially in remission was about that.
Wow. And you, I have to applaud you for really speaking up about what was important to you, because I think so many people, they don't do that at the beginning, or they're too scared to do that or to confront a doctor to say, hey, this is important to me. This part of quality of life is something I really want to work on and focus on. Because so many people are, rightly so, they're stunned in that moment that they've heard that news. But then some people almost lose their voice as soon as they've heard that diagnosis. And I think how being able to voice and give yourself power through that is just so important as well.
Yeah, because it's terrifying. You're confronted with these amazing doctors who know way more than I ever would about cancer, you know, and they are there to support you, and then you are, you know, very much at their mercy in a lot of ways. But then being able to have a little bit of space, write down questions. And also I remember saying to my dad and my husband, if I forget, because obviously it is a bit stunned mullet when you're being told this information, if I forget, I want to ask about fertility. So getting that on some other people that are there as well so that it can be in their minds, having it written down. I used to have loads of questions written down before I went into every appointment. Some of them I forgot to ask even still, but, you know, it helps.
It helped. The intention was there. The intention was there.
And just being confident and comfortable enough to ask, well, what are my options? Because when I transferred from my diagnosing oncologist to the public system, so I went to the public system for my treatment, just asking them, okay, well, what are my fertility options? What can I do? I know all about what I can't do. I know all about what might happen. But what is available to me? And for my situation, my cancer was too far advanced for IVF. I didn't have time for IVF. They do in WA, there is one, I believe it's one, there's probably more now, but clinics that do IVM.
Oh, okay.
Essentially very expensive, very fast IVF. Because we didn't think there was going to be a thing. So it was nothing covered by Medicare or medical insurance. So that was all of our savings gone. Another financial impact of cancer, which people don't realise or talk about.
And you're not working.
No.
So.
And I was a contractor, so there was no sick leave. So a massive financial implication. But it was my option, and my partner and I chose to take that option because they could do IVM in 2 weeks as opposed to 6 weeks for IVF. So I spoke to my oncologist about that and said, look, this is what I want to do. This is my option. I also had Zoladex implants to try and protect my ovaries as well. So I took the question of saying, okay, I hear, because naturally in the medical world as well, it is very much they have to prepare you for all the options, all the worst case scenarios.
Absolutely.
But quite often you have to really ask for the alternative scenarios.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with asking. Like, no.
Absolutely not.
No,
you did the same thing, didn't you? Like the way, as you said, you changed the way you heard language or you spoke language. You really also, as you beautifully said before, I asked, what are my options? I know what I can't do, but what are they? And yeah, what a way to change that perspective and also take control of that as well.
Just giving you that choice again, that sort of choice coming back into it, whereas I get that this is a really serious situation where I may not like my options. Quite often I've had, you know, to choose between two really shit options. But at least you have the the information available to make those choices and ask for those questions and ask, like when I said to my oncologist, I said, well, can I have the time to do IVM, which is shorter than IVF? So it was sort of a negotiation between the two of us. And that's the thing with treatment. It doesn't have to be a one-way street. You don't have to just do what you're told.
You're a team.
You're a team and you're a person. You're not just a number or a statistic or just there to sort of literally just absorb. You can absolutely negotiate and talk with your team and ask the questions. And admittedly, sometimes I'd ask questions and I didn't like either option.
Yeah, that sucks. But you asked. Yeah, but you asked. I think that's so – it's so right that it's – you have to find your voice within that. And, you are a team. And if you don't like the answer, well, you've asked and you're not going to stew on it either. And you're not going to go, oh, I should have asked that, or they haven't presented this to me. But you've got to take control and participate in your own treatment and absolutely. Treatment plan as well.
Absolutely. An active participant, not a passive recipient. I use that all the time for anything in life generally, but particularly within treatment. And sometimes it's easier said than done when you're towards the end and you're knackered and you're very, very low on everything. That's when those – either the list that you've written down comes in, or bring an advocate with you, a friend or a family member with you who you've spoken to beforehand when you had a bit more strength, and that they can then advocate for you. There's still ways that you can do it without with support. Again, finding ways to support yourself and not feeling like there is only ever one option.
Absolutely. And how you said that survivorship was a really big part of your journey and it was really difficult. How was that? What did that look like for you? I mean, treatment finished and people can be like, oh God, you get those constant checks of, reassurance of that everything's going okay. How did transitioning to survivorship go for you?
Yeah. So I think, and people laugh at me with this, the living side of it was even more confusing than the dying side. which it takes a bit of getting your head around, and it was incredibly confronting when I was in remission because you're over the moon, you are literally cloud nine. You've just been given a second lease on life. You just won the lottery essentially, and you are so excited and so grateful, as are your friends and family. And your friends and family go, oh, thank God that's over, on we go. And just for them, it's finished. It's done.
And the race is over.
Yeah, the race is over. And in their mind, I remember talking to my therapist about this and saying, but why do I feel like I've been hit by a truck and that I can't move on and I'm still bald? I don't look like myself. I might not be able to have kids. I'm fortunate enough they kept my job so I can go back to my job. So I went back to FIFO bald. And my relationship with my family's changed, and my thoughts about what I thought my life was going to be have changed. My relationship with my husband has changed. Why do I feel like I'm not okay? And she laughed at me and she goes, probably because you're not.
Is it not obvious?
Okay, but I should be feeling on top of the world. I am feeling on top of the world. So why do I feel like I've been hit by a truck as well? And she used the analogy, and I use it to try and explain these days as well, is that people think that you've run a 100-meter sprint and you're on the podium and you're chugging champagne and you're lifting your gold cup medal and saying, yeah, I've survived. This is great. We've won. And it is. But actually, you've just run an ultra marathon race through the middle of Antarctica with no shoes on and no idea what you're doing and no training, and you're just literally limped over the finish line, and you've now got to bring yourself back into life again slowly and recover from a hugely life impacting event, physically, mentally, spiritually, emotionally, whichever, it's impacted every aspect of your life, I would have.
And financially.
And you've got to start piecing that together again, but in a way that it will never be the same. So you absolutely, as like I say, you are a blank slate, literally, from your bald head through to your no eyebrows, no eyelashes. I was literally a blank slate.
Yeah.
But so is your life. And trying to, even know where to start, trying to explain that to people, feeling very confused about feeling that way, about not just feeling on top of the world. Now, when I talk to sort of AYA cancer survivors or in groups and things like that, the amount of times people say to me, oh, my God, I thought it was just me. Oh, my God, I thought it was just me.
It's not.
And I just want to scream it from the rooftops. It's not just you. It's really not just you. Oh, my God. Like the, in fact, I don't think I've met any AYA cancer patient who hasn't had those feelings, to be perfectly honest. And the feeling that survivorship is really tough because of the expectations and the lack of understanding and awareness and support out there for that stage. So you are literally left to fend for yourself, feeling like you're alone, feeling like why what do I do next? Why is this all happening? How do I overcome this? And how do I get back to or start living my life again when everything has changed? And every time I meet an AYA cancer survivor, it's just that connection that you say, oh my God, you get it. You get it. You understand. Yes. You get it.
I don't have to explain myself.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that unspoken rule of you get it and I'm not alone. And there have been some wonderful connections that I have made since in the survivorship space with other AYA cancer patients, but we are few and far between. We are, you know, the unicorn in the corner of the chemo room where we are, you know, 50, 60 years younger than everybody else in the chemo room.
Yes.
We are blind by nature. Online has helped, I think. Online opens up a lot of doors, but there's definitely a lot to be said in the inclusivity space around AYA cancer patients, because a lot of support services forget that for AYA patients, if it's a support service like a support group during the day, we're at work or we've got child.
Yes.
All those sorts of little things that with survivorship sometimes counts us out because we're not available. We're in a different stage. Whereas if we're retired, we are available during the day.
Yes. And some services you're almost penalized for your age, because if you're not under 18, you can't access that. If you're not over 55 or 60, you can't access those services. So there is a big period where people, as you say, are left to defend for themselves. And unlike hospital, when you're prescribed a treatment plan, you're not prescribed a survivorship plan. And everybody is so individual, and you're holding to emotions at that time, as you beautifully explained. You can have such excitement and, you know, hope for the future again, but then also being so scared, so fearful, and just shattered from what you've gone through. And it's, how do you manage that by yourself and going, oh gosh, I need to get back to work because financially I have no money, and trying to function back in the normal world amongst everything else whilst feeling those is just incredibly tough. And I agree, more needs to be done to support people.
It's totally like you say, and it is, I appreciate and understand that there are a lot of factors that go into support services and any kind of cancer service, of course. But to be ringing up places to ask for support and being told you're too old for young person cancer, but you're too young for old person cancer. And I was like, okay, well what cancer do I have and how can I get some support?
Yes, because I know I had it.
definitely still a person with cancer, so how do I get some support? Yes. And I would shockingly be turned away from support services, and it's heartbreaking for the person on the other end of the phone, because they say, you know, I really want to help you and I really feel that you need support here, but my hands are tied. And I totally, as I say, I understand the ins and outs of the back end of a lot of funding, and there's a lot of requirements, but there needs to be more of a, I always liken it to the fact that especially with the AYA bracket, it doesn't really matter what cancer you had or what treatment you had. Mm-hmm. It's the shared survivorship, the lifestyle impacts afterwards. Yeah. Yes, there are naturally differences between the cancer you had, of course, and there will be differences in treatment. So at that stage in the sort of cancer journey, there is that need for different support and different sort of support groups and connections. more relative to your particular type of cancer. Mm. However, afterwards, in the survivorship stage, yes, there are still some differences. Like some people are on ongoing treatment, some people are on sort of maintenance hormones or medication or anything like that, and some people have long-term side effects, some people don't. So there are differences in that space. However, the shared connection is through survivorship. It's not through your type of cancer. It's through, I was a young independent woman who literally had the rug pulled out from under her feet. What do I do now? And I relate far more to a 29-year-old woman with breast cancer than I do to a 79-year-old man with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which generally for me, they are old men.
Yeah. And I think also too, people's the mental health and well-being of people, the support that's needed is somewhat the same, as you say, no matter what treatment you've had or what diagnosis you've had or your age, the age that you are, is that is such a focus that anybody should tap in at any time. And I speak to people down and they go, oh, but I'm 3 years post. I should be over this. I should be back in life, or 5 years or even 1 year or months past. You go, but everybody's story is different, and you can't compare as to where Vicky, where you are today, and where somebody is who was diagnosed around the same time. There's just like the disease and the doctors and treatments would have said to you, you can't compare. Yeah. And I think survivorship in some way is almost the same as well. You can't compare or judge yourself against someone else because they're not you.
Completely. And everyone's situation is different, you know, financially, emotionally, physically. There is some shared similarities, which is that camaraderie, that kind of, oh, you get it, you understand. But really, like, and I'll put my hand on my heart and say, before I had cancer, I thought that every single cancer was the same, every chemo was the same, and everyone lost weight and lost their hair. Thanks, Hollywood. It's not that.
Got a different version for you.
A little bit. But yeah, that won't sell any movies. So
No, it's too raw and too honest.
Exactly, it's too real. But yeah, I will be very honest and say that I was completely naive to all of that before. Mm. And as you would expect people to be, until they've sort of experienced some of it through it. But yeah, there's definitely space, I think, for some shared understanding around the more psychosocial impacts of cancer. And the bit that happens when treatment ends, because there's a lot of sort of a common saying in a lot of groups that cancer doesn't end when treatment ends, but that
it's
sort of defined in society as over, you've finished your treatment, you're hopefully in remission, which is the best thing that anyone can ask for, and it is like winning the lottery. But then there's a whole stage of, well, how do you live the rest of your life after? With the fear of recurrence, with, you know, a changed body image, with financial impacts, relationship impacts, career impacts, just mental impacts of being told you might die. How do you start living again? Nobody helps you with that. Nobody prepares for that.
No, and the things that you just named are all things that you actually physically can't see, whereas when you're diagnosed, you can physically see that you are unwell and that you've lost your hair, you've lost weight, you might have lost muscle tone or not be able to do what you did, but all those things like financial, mental, the society can't see that, and things that society can't see are the things that we're very good at dismissing because then we don't have to deal with it. So how did you go, as you said, you went back to work, how did you deal with that transition and I guess I hate the word moving forward but how did you get to kind of almost where you are today?
I continued doing the things that I enjoyed that I had stopped doing because, as we said, adulting was getting in the way. So I continued that. I continued a lot of my counselling and my therapies to help support my health and wellness, which at 29, I hadn't really been focusing on, I'll be completely honest. Yep. Hadn't even really crossed my mind. So it was very much a continuation of a lot of the things that had supported me through treatment. I used to support myself through survivorship as well. A lot of talking therapy. I'm a massive advocate for counselling, either formal or informal. It doesn't have to be, you know, down the psychologist route if that doesn't suit you. There's many other types of sort of talking therapies and counselling that can help. And just continuing for me to be very transparent with my friends and family, even if it was uncomfortable for them, and they're confused, they're just as confused as you are. They're like, well,
yes,
really, I'm not sure what to say. And again, it's that allowing that
space, that's okay,
for the not sure what to say is, as opposed to the alternative, which is the toxic positivity band-aid of you'll be fine, you'll be right, you'll get over it.
You can't say that to a cancer patient who's had something really bad delivered to them, because it's not always fine or okay.
No, and it's learning to manage anxieties and fears around reoccurrence. It's learning to trust your body again, because there's a lot of mistrust around, for me personally, how the hell did I get to stage four body without you telling me? Like, why?
Yes, building trust again.
Building that trust again, which is a very challenging part. And it's creating an identity again. As I mentioned before, a blank slate. I had had an identity based on who I used to look like, and now I had to build an identity of who I wanted to be and where I wanted to be. And it takes time. I remember thinking, my hair took so long to grow, and my eyelashes, it was my eyelashes I missed the most, because sticking on false eyelashes at 3 a.m. is hard work.
And I can say to the listeners, you've got some beautiful head of hair and eyelashes and gorgeous eyebrows now. thanks pregnancy. Yeah. But would I be right in saying you actually have to, as we said, be an active participant in your survivorship, that it doesn't get delivered to you, and it doesn't just happen, that you have to take control and do the work? Is I know everyone, you've done just such a hard marathon before that, but the marathon is still here to get you.
And I think it's more of a case of it's almost like the cool down after the marathon. So you're walking, you're not running for your life anymore. You're not, you know, literally trying to limp over that finish line so that it's finished, it's done. Your cool down may last 12 months, it may last 12 years, you just don't know, but
it may last forever, to be honest.
There's no real, you know, finish line, and as it were, goalpost in sight, and you get to choose the pace, and you get to choose. Now, sometimes it's slower than you want. Sometimes it feels like a lifetime to try and recover, and then that gives you sometimes the slowness and the space to really work out, well, what do I want to do? Like, I know that I have a tendency to take on too much, but physically I couldn't. So it was a case of, I'm going to have to really focus on, well, what do I want to do, and what can I do? What am I able to do? And it was a real slowdown for me on my life.
Yes.
Which is, you know, in some ways it's beautiful, in other ways it's really frustrating.
Yes.
Yeah. It's being able to take both sides of that coin, and then just, as I say, sometimes look at the language, look at where you're at, how do you want to come out of this, who can support you out of this.
Yeah.
If you're hitting loads of roadblocks while trying to get sort of more traditional support, like through charities or through the hospital or through the medical avenue, what other options are available to me? Mm. It might be more of a social support. It might be joining a club or joining a sports group if you're feeling well enough, or even online.
Yeah.
I mean, online can be a little bit of a lion's den sometimes in the cancer world.
Yep.
So take what you need, and if it's not giving you what you need, unfriend, get out of those groups, remove yourself from that environment.
Reject yourself.
Yeah, totally. Like, online can be brilliant, and online can be intense in the cancer world as well, because there's a lot of confronting stuff that goes on and comes up in those groups too. So just protect yourself. And if it's not adding to your survivorship support and it's making you feel worse, just come out.
Move on. Yep.
Come out and look for something different. And whether that's, like I say, trying something new or something old, you know, that you used to love, or that you said, I've wanted to do this for like forever, and do it. Find some way
why not?
Yeah, and give it a go. If you love it, great. If you don't, you did it. And you try something.
Yeah, exactly.
A lot of trial and error. There's definitely, there's no, as we said, there's no magic pill for survivorship because it's not all the same. Everyone is different. So it is a lot of trial and error, but it's being able to have a bit more fun with that error, I guess.
Yeah. And willing to do it too, yeah, as well. Willing to give it
a go. Open mind is an option and you can try it. And if that option's not for you, you don't have to do it again.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, because I know that we're nearing almost now and I'm nosy and I know that you have a beautiful baby girl and one on the way, a baby on the way, how did that story unfold? How did you get to where you sit now? Because I know so many people, male or female, will be interested to know what happened for you there.
Yeah, it's definitely a story. So as I've mentioned before, the fertility aspect of it was the most confronting side effect of my cancer treatment. I actually got tested. So I did IVM, or we did IVM, sorry. It wasn't particularly successful. We managed to get one. And then the Zoladex implants to try and protect my ovaries. When I went for the testing after 12 months, because they told me I had to wait, I had what they deem as negligible egg reserves. So essentially there was nothing left there, which was, again, like being hit by a bus again.
Yeah, being diagnosed all over
again. Yeah, because I'd done everything. I'd made the choices I could make. I'd done everything within my power to try and protect my ovaries. We still had one in the freezer and one's better than none, but it was very much a heartbreaking moment to think, wow, there's nothing there at 29. I was 30 by that point, but yeah. So again, that took a lot of healing and a lot of recovery. And then the doctor said to me, look, if you want to try, you can try IVF, but we're not particularly hopeful. But that is, again, I asked, well, what are my options? And she said that is your only option. Your only option is to try and retrieve, or try and investigate if there is even anything to retrieve. And we'd postponed our honeymoon from the wedding for a few years.
Yeah.
We went away and I spoke to my husband and we just decided that I didn't want to be doing medication while we're on our honeymoon. We thought that we were just going to give it a few more months, go on honeymoon. Then when we came back, we would go into IVF if that was what was required. But we'd just try naturally and just see what happened. And sometimes the tests are wrong. So naturally was one egg hiding there under negligible result. There was definitely one little lady in there still hiding away. So I was definitely more shocked than anyone else.
Oh my god. And I'm sure the doctors were too.
Every maternity appointment I went to, they went, so how did you where did you have IVF and all this kind of stuff? And I went, no. And then they'd look at my results.
I did it myself.
So these are your results. Yeah. I know that that is not the case for a lot of people. And I am very mindful and sensitive of this is my experience and my story for myself. However, I do share often because when I was looking for people like me, when I was diagnosed, people who had children after my treatment or people who were my age who had managed to fall pregnant, either naturally or with assistance, either way, I couldn't find anyone. Nobody could give me anyone. And so now I speak about it to say that there are people out there, even with, negligible results, even with medical results that say you can't.
This is impossible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And yes, as there will be many variations on a theme, everyone is different. But for me, that was my choice to keep trying anyway, do different things, again, different supportive therapies and things like that through and up to my honeymoon. And then, same with this second pregnancy. He was a little harder to come by. We did go back to the fertility clinic to ask about the implantation of the embryo that we had, and then he was here without. So another negligible egg that was hiding away.
Wow. The results were wrong again.
Yeah.
Oh, what two blessed miracles.
Two very much miracle babies. And as I say, I do talk about it to give people hope, the hope that there are alternatives to test results, or there are alternatives, there are options, there is hope, there are people like me out there. And again, if it's not that case for you, then you have choices and options, and just keep asking the questions. Okay, well, if this is what this looks like, what can I do with this, or what are my options? And that's, I think, where it came down to with these babies, is that I just chose my option. My option was to wait for a little bit before we did IVF, so I waited. I can't, apart from my honeymoon, where I didn't want to be taking injections with me and trying to find fridges in the middle of the Central American jungle and all that kind of stuff. I can't really tell you.
That would have been a bit hard.
I can't really sort of find another reason, but that was my reason at the time.
Yeah.
That was my choice. Yeah. Our choice, sorry. And so for me, it was definitely a roller coaster to get to this stage. And I'm now 5 years post diagnosis, maybe a bit longer than that, 5.5. And I still am working through survivorship. Even though my worst fears were not confirmed, I have had, you know, one beautiful girl and I'm pregnant with another one. It's still something that I work on. Survivorship is still something that I work on constantly. And it's something that, it's not a negative thing that it's in my life every day. It's not necessarily a positive thing that it's in my life every day, but it is my life now. I have no choice. That I have no choice over, ironically.
Choice over. Yes, exactly.
And that's the one thing I don't have a choice about.
No.
And I will always be somebody who, again, language choices, that I survived my cancer. Like, that will always be part of my life. And it will always be an impact on my decisions, on my choices. But it's how I choose to look at that and go from there.
Yeah. Oh, you have left us with some pearls and some wisdom that I just, I can't thank you enough. And I think what I've really learned from you is the power of a voice and the power of your, you know, being able to see your choices through the darkness. Like, they can be really hard to see when it's pitch dark, but I think to know and feel that they are there. But unfortunately, again, when you're at your worst, you have to put yourself into it, and you have to search for them as definitely. Well.
And it's not easy, and it is disheartening to be turned away. It's not easy to ask for help for a lot of people.
Oh no,
and it's absolutely not easy to, like you say, when we were talking about earlier, a lot of the things that can't be seen. So when your hair's grown back, or you know, all those sorts of things, that all the sort of mental or the financial or the social or the emotional side of things that you can't necessarily just see in a person. It's definitely, that's the side that I think we need to remember if we are going through it, or if this is family and friends listening. That's the side of things that it will be a longer journey than just when the bell rings and the remission comes, and just to be there open-minded and even saying, I don't know, I don't understand, how can I help? But just to keep reaching out for help and keep asking for support, because it will be there. It might just not be at the first door that you knock on.
Keep knocking.
Definitely. There are things out there, I promise, and you're not alone. It's so common. And
I don't think there's anything left to say. I think you've just wrapped it up so beautifully and perfectly. So I think that we'll just leave it there, shall we? And from the Leukemia Foundation and the people that are listening, we cannot thank you enough, and we wish you all the very best for the next adventure that you're about to embark on. And good luck to those sleepless nights, and remember that this too shall pass when the bubba is screaming. So
thank you.
This too shall pass.
Appreciate that. Thanks.
Thank you. And that brings us to the end of today's episode. We hope that you found it helpful in some way. If you would like more information on today's show or our services, please feel free to contact 1-800-620-420, and someone will be able to connect you with your local blood cancer support coordinator. Also, if you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe, share, or even give us a rating on your podcast app. Thank you for tuning in today. I'm Kate Arkadiff, and you've been listening to the Leukemia Foundation's podcast, Talking Blood Cancer.